Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
All right, this is episode 323. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode, Yule is Coming, where we covered some of the frequent themes of the upcoming season. I know some of you got a kick out of the meme we put up as the episode artwork, the Brace Yourself meme, Yule is Coming. In the news this week, I wanted to mention just a few things. First of all, last week on the Masonic Roundtable, we had a wonderful episode about Hermeticism, episode 190. So if you're into that, please go check that out, themasonicroundtable.com, and it should be the first or second episode up there. Now, if you're listening to this way in the future, then you're looking for episode 190, which was published November 28th, 2017. So this week, other news, I want to mention that the Masonic Curators Preservation Through Storytelling is up and running. Now, the way we did it was the first five or six episodes were on the WCY podcast channel as well as the Masonic Curators channel. It's a separate channel. And from now on, those will be just on its own channel. So we're going to keep them separate so that way people who are not into it don't have to see that in their feed. So if you're interested in it, please go to MasonicCurators.com or, as in our videos, curators.wcypodcast.com, and it'll take you always to the same place. And I'm very happy to announce that one of the things with Masonic Curators is that I've got a lot of stuff to span years to cover on videos, and it's kind of like a vlog in that sense that we're telling the stories about these items and our feelings, our connections, the nostalgia behind them. Now, of course, it's super fun for me to be doing this. I love telling the stories, but there's so many of you with stories, and I think it would just be the coolest thing in the world to have anyone submit stories about their items. And this won't be me telling the story. I would like to put it out there, and you can visit the website today, and just if you go to MasonicCurators.com or again curators.wcypodcast.com, you'll see a tab for, it'll say Home, About, and Submissions. Click on Submissions, and it says, do you have something you want to tell us about? Let's showcase it. So if you can follow these guidelines, I would love for you to put together something, and let's get it up on the YouTube channel. So these must be shot in either MP4 or MPG, MPEG format. The audio must be loud enough to hear it plainly at a quarter volume. So whatever your max volume is on your computer, turn it up to quarter volume. If you can hear it well, then good. You're good to go. If not, then you need to bump that audio up a little bit, either inside, you know, your iMovie on your iPhone or on your computer or whatever you're using. You need to shoot it in a resolution not less than 420. So no video less than 420 can be accepted because we need to make sure things are set for HD screens. We also need not more than 5 minutes in length. So try to keep it under 5 minutes. It needs to be about a Masonic object. Tell us how you got it, what it is, and what it means to you. And tell us your name in the video, your lodge, and I want you to open the show. So you'll say, welcome to Masonic Curators, I'm Brother John Paul Jones. And then tell your story and wow us with it. I would love to hear these. And finally, close out the show. Thanks for watching Masonic Curators. We'll see you next time. Something along those lines. Use your own flavor. And then what we'll do is we'll review them. Now, all videos will get reviewed. Not all will be accepted. I'm sure there's going to be some that we're going to need to send back and say, can you reshoot this or whatever, for whatever reason. But be ready for that. I'm not being mean. I have to be a little bit picky about the content that's going to go up. So submissions should be uploaded to Google Drive. So once you make your movie, upload it to Google Drive or put it up on YouTube as a private video so that you can just share a link, and so only people with a link can see it. And then if you can send me that link, send it over to wcypodcast@gmail.com, and I will download it, and we'll go ahead and we'll turn it into the video. We'll add the bumpers and everything, and then we'll schedule it up. So I think it's really exciting. It's going to allow everybody to tell a cool story, and I'm really excited about it. So I hope you're excited about it. I hope you are listening to this going, I've got something I can talk about. I've got two brothers right now who are working on something, and it just sounds amazing. I think what they've got to share blows any of the videos that I've done away already. So please be ready for those, and please submit your story. Also this week, we have a wonderful piece by illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison, who brings us the Masonic Minute, a brand new one this week. Very cool. It's called Clichés. Oh, and I almost forgot. Of course, there is the new Masonic Curators on Facebook, so they have a Facebook page, and there's a Twitter for it. Those will be all linked up, and if you'd like, please check those out, follow, and like those. That way you are always getting the updates. There is a website, and the website updates with the videos, and there's a little subscribe button right on our website, so you can do that as well. But the more guys we reach, the more stories we can tell, the more preservation we have, and the more we drive this mission of kind of preserving our Masonic history in this particular way. So with that, let's get into this week's piece. It's called A Modern Pythagorean, and it's by Dana Lloyd Thomas. And it's not terribly lengthy, but it is a longer article. So let's go ahead and dive right in. No study of esoteric culture in Italy in this century can fail to mention Arturo Ruggini, 1878 to 1946, a writer, translator, mathematician, and above all, Pythagorean. He played a key role in the revival of scholarship on esotericism in Italy, as well as in the attempt to restore the spiritual traditions of Freemasonry. Ruggini's books and articles cover a variety of subjects, including Masonic symbolism, theosophy, Neoplatonism, Cornelius, Agrippa, and Cagliostro. As editor of the magazines Ignis and Etanor, he published articles by the noted esotericists René Guénon and Julius Evola. Later, he was to pay for his outspokenness, especially on behalf of freedom of conscience when Freemasonry was outlawed by the fascist regime. Born in Florence on November 12th of 1878, Ruggini was the eldest of five children. His career as a philosopher, in the classical sense of lover of wisdom, began early in life, when his aristocratic family sent him to the University of Pisa to study mathematics. The tall, thin, young student was approached one evening by a stranger who singled him out as a candidate for initiation into the Mysteries Pythagorean School, also known as the Scala Italica. The stranger turned out to be Amedeo Armentano, 1886 to 1966, who fascinated literary circles in Florence with his abstruse, laconic reasoning about time, mind, and soul, as well as with the psychic powers. Ruggini was initiated in the highest sense of the word. He experienced the trial of the five elements not only as a ceremony, but as a profound reality. For him, passing beyond the threshold of death was a matter of experience, vision, and knowledge rather than a mere symbol. To understand Ruggini's role in the esoteric culture of his time, it is helpful to have some background on Italian Freemasonry and its connection to historical events. As in other countries, the craft in Italy has so many facets that there is little point in overgeneralizing. For some, Masonry has commanded a virtually religious allegiance in the observance of the quote-unquote ancient and accepted rules and ceremonies, while others undoubtedly saw this as a means of improving society at large based on 19th century rationalist beliefs in progress, education, and science. The ranks of Masonry have also included an eminent minority of philosophers and mystics, as well as the usual opportunists. Finally, there are the anti-Masonic elements, initially Catholic and later spreading to both left and right-wing politicians and thinkers. In any case, the political and esoteric aspects of Freemasonry have often run parallel throughout Italian history. The first known Italian lodge was founded in Florence by Charles Sackville, Earl of Middlesex, Henry Fox, and Sir Charles Mann in about 1730. Although by this time Florentine Renaissance traditions were but a distant memory, Tuscany, under the later Medici, had still managed to preserve some independence, sparing it from the worst excess of counter-reformation. Lodges were soon open in Rome, Naples, Turin, and elsewhere, but the craft's connection with England, a major Protestant power, aroused the suspicions of both the rulers of the Italian states and the ecclesiastical hierarchy. In 1738, when Pope Clement XII issued the Bull Eminenti, which in practice banned Catholics from becoming Freemasons, he had reached the venerable age of 87 and was completely blind. Firmly continuing the papacy's penchant for power politics, the measure seems to have been initially rooted in concern about the situation in the Pope's native Tuscany and was probably formulated mainly with Italy in mind. It may have been of no coincidence that the last of the Medici, Gian Gastone, had died a year before. The move could have had the aim of both of striking a blow against the suspicious Protestant organization and of reasserting papal influence in relative tolerant Tuscany. Nevertheless, this independence persisted when Francis of Lorraine, himself a Freemason, became Tuscany's new ruler. The papal stance marked the start of the persecution. The poet Tommaso Crudelli, the first known Masonic martyr, was tortured to make him reveal, quote-unquote, the secrets of the Freemasons, but he was released upon Francis's intervention. Several decades later, the celebrated Magus Count Alessandro Cagliostro was not to be so lucky and would die in 1795 while imprisoned in the papal fortress of San Leo. Of the papal ban, Righini wrote, quote, "The effect of the Church's hostility was to cause a reaction in some countries, with Freemasonry being forced to defend itself by becoming a secret society. Nevertheless, it never became sectarian, and the rituals were always characterized by the tolerance, non-sectarianism, and independence of the early period." End quote. Masons and the Masonic organization played a significant role in the Italian resurrection of the 19th century. Freemasons actively promoted the unification of Italy's many states, thus winning them further condemnation for subversion. Giuseppe Mazzini's political organization, Giovine Italia, or Young Italy, was dedicated to unification, shared Masonic ideals of humanity, progress, and secular government. The Italian Grand Orient was founded in 1859. In 1862, a sovereign council of the Scottish Rite convened in Palermo under the guidance of the patriot Giuseppe Garibaldi, and in 1864, the first Congress of Italian Freemasonry met in Florence and elected Garibaldi as Grand Master. Perhaps even more than the French Revolution, the Resurrection was a quote-unquote bourgeois revolution, and Freemasonry attracted Italy's small but active middle class. It was seen as a means of keeping together forces as diverse as Mazzini's Republicans, monarchists who supported the House of Savoy, and Garibaldi's quote-unquote red shirts. As one scholar points out, quote, "In a country where all the forms of political conflicts had a regional basis, the lodges were the only real school of national unity." End quote. As a result of the Church's continuing opposition to unification, Masonry persisted in its anti-clerical stance. In the decades following the country's unification in 1870, numerous members of the new class of politicians and administrators were Freemasons. By the end of the 19th century, Freemasonry was widely perceived as a part of the establishment and as affording advantages that were often more material than spiritual. Financial scandals and political instability had made establishment politicians vulnerable to attack, and Freemasonry, previously seen as the champion of independence and democracy, was now accused of being class-ridden and corrupt. As in other Latin countries, many anti-Masonic pamphlets were circulated, generally based on the conspiracy charges by the Abbe Barule and Leo Taxil, and creating the impression that the institution was much more powerful and monolithic than it actually was. These ideas undoubtedly influenced Benito Mussolini in his early years in the Socialist Party and were to resurface in the fascist period 1922-1943, despite the Masonic connections of many fascist leaders. The fascist movement founded in 1919 counted a number of Freemasons among its first members who were attracted by the variety of factors, including the movement's early anti-clerical and revolutionary leanings. Persecution, though not always systematic, continued until the fall of the regime. Paradoxically, as soon as World War II ended, anti-Masonic literature was revived, this time with the accusations of collaboration with fascism. In recent decades, historical research on Italian Freemasonry has largely been monopolized by the Catholic and communist-oriented writers who are, for different reasons, hostile toward the institution. It is therefore no wonder what a Masonic writer has observed that, quote, "Italian Masonry is probably the most misrepresented and misunderstood in the world," end quote. Italian Freemasonry was not all politics, however, and has always had a strong esoteric strain, together with the specifically Masonic symbolism of building and architecture, probably rooted in medieval guilds, various esoteric traditions, including Rosicrucianism, Kabbalistic, Templar, and Pythagorean lines have converged in the craft. From the earliest times, Freemasonry has considered geometric symbolism to be a part of the highest importance, with the Pythagorean theorem being widely depicted in Masonic art. It has been suggested that some form of Pythagorean initiation survived through the centuries, first in the Byzantine Empire and later as the Ottoman Turks advanced in Italy, where the Greek intellectual elite took refuge. During the reign of Elizabeth I, Sir Thomas Bodley is said to have been initiated in the northern Italian city of Forli into the Pythagorean brotherhood of the Fratelli Obscuri, having the laudable object of propagating the sciences and love of virtue, and established an imitation of an older society which had existed since before the fall of the Grecian Empire in the towns of Constantinople and Thessalonica. In the 18th century, the British and French Pythagoreans came to be known as quote-unquote snuff-takers when they adopted the tobacco plant as their symbol. Naples was the home of Egyptian Freemasonry, a tradition claiming descent from the Hermetic community dating back to the Hellenistic Egypt. There is still a quote-unquote Nile Square in the city, and Giordano Bruno, who exalted the quote-unquote wisdom of Egypt, was from nearby Nola. The school subsequently came to light through the work of Cagliostro and later Giuliano Cremers, founder of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Miriam. Cagliostro's Gospel, first published in Italian in 1914 and later commented on by Reggini, uses alchemical terminology to describe a path to immortality, as well as propounding the use of magical seals, meditation, fasting, and a vegetarian diet. The esoteric order of Mizraim, whose name is derived from the Hebrew name for Egypt, seems to have had Italian origins. The Mizraim first emerged in Italy in the 18th century when it was associated with Cagliostro, who brought it to Venice around 1788. Because both Egyptian Freemasonry and the Order of Mizraim allow the admission of women, thus violating the basic Masonic guidelines known as the quote-unquote landmarks, and because they work degrees beyond the third, they are generally classified as part of fringe Masonry. The Order of Mizraim was introduced into France after 1813 by Bitterride brothers. Afterward, it spread to Belgium, Switzerland, Britain, and the United States. It consists of two forms of practice, the Kabbalistic form adopted by the Bitterides and the Egyptian Hellenistic form of the highest degrees known as the Arcana Arcanorum. Politics, again, crossed paths with the esoteric when Garibaldi was appointed Grand Hierophant of the Mizraim in 1880. At that time, the order was joined with the Order of Memphis, whose rituals were inspired by Egyptian imagery. By the end of the century, the combined order was to provide a link between Freemasonry and Theosophy in Italy. Both H.P. Blavatsky and Annie Besant held high degrees. When he was only 18, Reggini went to Rome, where he was introduced to Isabel Cooper Oakley, Blavatsky's delegate to Italy, and in 1898 the two were among the founders of the Italian branch of the Theosophical Society. Blavatsky had always had a weakness for Italy. She even claimed to have fought with Garibaldi against French and papal forces at the Battle of Mentana in 1867. Theosophy, too, was soon open to accusations of heresy, if not outright paganism, thus attracting the hostility of the church. Yet, the Theosophical Society proved to be an important vehicle for broadening the horizons of educated and open-minded Italians by introducing the study of Oriental philosophy and religion, until then largely limited to academic circles, to a wider public. While already receiving instruction at the Pythagorean tradition, Reggini started his Masonic career with initiation into the Order of Memphis and Mizraim in 1902. What did he find in the esoteric forms of Freemasonry? He was probably told something like these comments by a modern Masonic writer. The Rite of Memphis and Mizraim is not suited to every Mason, but is intended for those few brothers who, following the many indications and revelations to be found in the rituals, genuinely aspire to enter into the Renaissance with the higher planes of existence, and to overcome their individuality. In this case, the rite is a visible, tangible link between the lower sphere and the upper sphere. It provides the key to the arcana, the way in which they can be revealed and practiced. The order's Osirian ritual contains suggestive references to Egypt, as when the aspiring master is told, quote, "Brother, you have entered this temple, which is the middle chamber of the pyramid, aspiring to become Osiris, and to achieve this privilege, you have recited the negative confession, well aware that it was only symbolic, the confession that every deceased person recites when reaching the world of shadows and coming before the tribunal of Osiris to identify himself with Osiris if his life has been pure." End quote. In 1903, Reggini joined a lodge in Florence that owed allegiance to the Italian Grand Orient. 2 years later, this was reorganized as the Lucifero Lodge, with Regini as one of the founders. At the same time, lodges in Milan merged with the Rome Grand Orient, with headquarters in Rome's Palazzo Giustiniani. Writing in 1906, Regini censored opposition to the higher degrees, from the 4th up to the 95th, in orders like Mizrim, and expressed regret over the failure of Mazzini and the American Albert Pikes to create a quote-unquote secret rite above all others, a sort of masonry within masonry, which would have unified the divided Masonic family. In 1908, a number of dissidents led by a Protestant minister broke away from the Grand Orient in protest against its overtly materialistic and radical political stance. They set up a new Masonic organization with its headquarters at Piazza del Gesù in Rome. Subsequently, Italy's two branches of Masonry were to be known as Palazzo Giustiniani and Piazza del Gesù, after the location of their Rome headquarters. An attempt to promote unification of the splintered Masonic groups by returning to the craft's early spiritual roots had been undertaken with the Italian Philosophical Rite, of which Regini was one of the founders. The name calls to mind the Scottish Philosophical Rite, thought to have some connection with British Pythagoreans. The Italian rite had 7 degrees and has been described as a mixture of Pythagorean and Gnostic elements. In 1911, Regini and Armentano wrote the rite statutes dictating that a copy of the Golden Verses of Pythagoras was to be placed in the temple together with the other objects used in lodge work. This experience was interrupted by World War I, which disrupted international fraternal contacts. Regini himself served in the army. The Philosophic Rite came to an end in 1919 when it was merged with the Grand Lodge Scottish Rite. Afterwards, Regini, while remaining a Freemason, would be more cautious about any quote-unquote universal reformation of the craft. In Italy, as in the rest of Europe and around the turn of the century, popular interest in the occult was largely focused on phenomena like hypnotism and spiritualism. Astrological and magical manuals copied from the classics, such as those by Cornelius Agrippa and Giovanni Battista della Porta, abounded. At the same time, the works of French writers like Eliphas Levi, Henri d'Urville, and Papus were gaining a considerable readership, and there were a number of esoteric journals. Regini himself translated Swami Vivekananda, the Egyptologist, E.A. Wallace Budge, and Robert Louis Stevenson's Occult Tales. Both Regini and Giuliano Kremers, active in Naples during the same period, stressed that theirs was a quest for knowledge and warned against the confusion between spiritual achievement and bouts of emotional excitement. In this respect, they rejected the occultism of seances and sects, sharing the position of Levi, who insisted that the occultism, a term he coined, was based on faith, science, and reason. This experimental method makes use not only of logic, but of analogy. Early in his career, Regini had written, quote, "The symbolism of architecture, ceremonies, and images is superior to ordinary languages due to the multitude of meanings which only symbolism can express, since it works through analogy, like the hieroglyphic and ideogram forms of writing are superior to ordinary writing due to the breadth and precision of their meaning," end quote. 20 years later, Regini expressed much the same idea. Quote, "There exists an oral tradition of hidden knowledge which cannot be transmitted with words, perceived and interpreted in the profane sense. There is still a serious tradition in the West which has nothing to do with the circus-like uproar, the parody of pretense of today's so-called occultism," end quote. Regini also sometimes retired with his friends Armentano and Giulio Parisi to an isolated tower on the coast of Calabria, ideal for study and meditation. Regini was also no stranger to ceremonial magic, though one of the few direct references he makes to it has humorous overtones, mentioning some of the practical difficulties of pre-dawn rituals with alarm clocks, cups of hot coffee, sputtering oil lamps, incense failing to burn, and candles going out, all to the detriment of the necessary quote-unquote spiritual concentration. Throughout all this activity, Regini remained a Pythagorean. What did this mean for him in practical terms? He engaged in the daily recollection of his deeds, a practice that has been traced back to Pythagoras, as well as the philosophical ecstasy, which was actually a type of meditation. The practitioner was to sit comfortably in a quiet place, emptying himself of all thoughts and emotions. He could either be in the dark or have a light behind him. Then, when the soul is purified and a bright and shining light from within, from which nothing can be hidden, seems to appear, says one old text, and then a sweet pleasure is felt, incomparable to anything else in this world, and an extremely pleasurable itch is felt inside the head. The person most suited to this ecstasy are those whose skull is open, through which the spirit can escape. I believe that this is a Platonic ecstasy, the one mentioned in Porphyry as having overcome Latinus 7 times. End quote. This practice has important implications as a form of Western yoga. It does not so much connote an evaluation of deeds as good or bad, but rather stresses the importance of remembering itself. The Renaissance mages, Tommaso Campanella and Giordano Bruno, were probably familiar with this meditation. Righini also stressed that the seeker aimed at the transformation of his soul by such techniques as breath control, meditation, and recollection, and that this transformation had to take place during one's lifetime. In Righini's time, the word pagan still had largely negative connotations and was widely used not to indicate historically documented religion, but rather as a synonym for immorality and materialism. Nevertheless, he found it to be the best term to sum up his own position. In a 1914 article entitled Imperialismo Pagano, he called for the spiritual rebirth of Italian culture in a new type of quote-unquote empire that would entail excellence in every field of human endeavor. This achievement would require freedom and tolerance, although history showed that unlike Greco-Roman paganism, the Abrahamic religions had all too often borne the bitter fruit of religious intolerance. Righini agreed that the fanatical attitude of the Christians from the earliest times had led to the fall of Rome and later to the papal policy of preventing Italy's unification. The avant-garde milieu in which Righini's ideas had matured was also focused on the problem of creating a new secular religion, free from defects of Catholicism yet based on spiritual value. Nevertheless, for Righini, any anti-Christian crusade would have been a contradiction in terms. Rather, he called for the classical distinction between popular and initiatic religion, subsequently developed by Guénon and others. He likewise condemned the materialism and rabid anti-clericalism of some of the Masonic community, and may have even cherished a dream of the day when the Catholic Church would have adopted the policy of St. Francis of Assisi, abandoning political and financial power to devote itself to the good works. While aiming at spiritual perfection, Righini believed Masonry should be non-sectarian. In his 1922 work on the meaning of the three basic Masonic degrees, he analyzes the symbolism of the initiation of the Master Mason, Hiram, Osiris, Dionysus, and Jesus. The initiate, he says, should become aware that the conscious mind does not depend on physical existence alone. He likewise chides some of his Anglo-American brothers for interpreting the 19th landmark requiring belief in God as a meaning that Masons must necessarily be Christians, reminding them that the square and compasses are placed on the top of the Bible. He also comments that both Continental and Anglo-American Masonry are more obsessed with high-sounding titles than with the spiritual perfection of the initiate. After moving to Rome in 1921, Righini devoted a considerable attention to fascism and to the relationship developing between Mussolini and the Vatican. Most of Italian Freemasonry, along with the nationalist and socialist dissidents led by Mussolini, had backed intervention in World War I, above all, to wrest the cities of Trent and Trieste from Italy's old enemy, Austria. After the war in 1920, the Grand Orient supported the occupation of the city of Fiume on the Adriatic in defiance of Italy's allies, France and Britain. This event was considered to be the final step in the national unification. When Mussolini's fascist government came to power in 1922, there was little hint of the disaster that was to befall Freemasonry. None of the better-known fascists were practicing Catholics. Indeed, some were known to be Freemasons. Unfortunately, however, Righini's warnings that the craft required spiritual renewal had gone unheeded, as would his attempts to prevent the regime from coming to an agreement with the church. In addition, the Masonic hierarchy did not prove to be skillful as their predecessors in avoiding a quote-unquote divide-and-conquer policy. Since the French Revolution, the ancient insignia of Roman power consisting of 12 birch rods bound together with an axe had had revolutionary anti-monarchist connotations, initially inspiring its adoption by the fascist party. For men like Righini, however, the symbol also evoked the ancient Romans' concept of republica, in which power was invested both in the people and in the aristocratic senate. Righini did not want to propose some new system of government. Rather, he hoped that spirituality-oriented and Pythagorean masonry would foster an elite political class whose members would be endowed with superior values. 1924 was a crucial year for Ruggini. In that year, the government decreed Masonic affiliation to be incompatible with the Fascist Party membership. A Jesuit journal published an article condemning Freemasonry on the grounds that being international, it was therefore un-Italian. This line was soon officially adopted by the fascists. Ruggini, a member of the Supreme Council of the Piazza del Gesù, Grand Lodge, replied that Masonry's key role in promoting the resurrection disproved this accusation beyond any doubt. By this time, however, historical arguments were of no avail, making him almost inadvertently a political dissident. In May, his friend, Armentano, who had continued to work with him in an aberrative attempt to reunify the two main branches of Italian Masonry, left for Brazil, and he hopes that Freemasons may have nourished for a change of heart in the regime were dashed by the anti-Masonic violence unleashed in November of 1925. A new law against secret societies did not specifically mention Freemasons, but the regime made it clear that they were the intended target. Mussolini asserted that the measures were to prevent political plots and not to suppress Freemasonry as a spiritual institution, but there was little difference when it came to police suppression. A number of top Grand Orient officials went into exile in France, while after an unsuccessful attempt to reorganize as the Order of St. John's of Scotland, the Piazza del Gesù was also forced to close. Ironically, the lack of systematic persecution against ordinary Freemasons led to Pope Pius XI to criticize the fascist regime for being quote-unquote too soft. In an article published in Fascism and the Vatican in 1927-1928, Ruggini, foreseeing the imminent alliance between Freemasonry and the Vatican, commented, "The current conditions of our country in relation to the political situation in Europe and the world would be favorable to someone who was willing and able to exploit them to create a new universal civilization starting from Rome. However, this type of imperialism could not be subservient to the force, which is universal in name only, whose innate and incurable intolerance is unacceptable to both the rest of the Western civilization and to the Oriental civilizations. We would proudly say more if we were not obliged today to use more prudent language than Agrippa was able to use 4 centuries ago." By this time, there could be no doubt that Ruggini's position was highly unorthodox. In a short time, he had graduated from being a gifted writer on the rather obscure subjects to being an unflinching public opponent of Mussolini's rapprochement with the Vatican, culminating in the 1929 Lateran Treaty. How could a self-declared pagan be allowed to publish freely after an alliance between the Church and Fascism? Ruggini's courage in the defense of Masonry was all the more remarkable considering his dim view of the craft as a whole for failing to fulfill its mission of perfecting the individual. Forced with the difficult situation, much of the Masonic hierarchy preferred to temporize. But after unsuccessful attempts to come to terms with the government, both the major Masonic branches declared themselves to be dissolved and would only reemerge in 1945. Ruggini's sacrifice gained him few friends either before or after the war. Attacks in the press continued, and Paris writes of attempts, quote, "to save my soul and Ruggini's with pistol shots. Surveillance was so close and overwhelming as to limit our contacts, since we were even afraid of compromising people who just happened to greet us," end quote. Ruggini was dismissed as a mathematics teacher in a public school in November of 1928 and had to make a living by teaching privately. In a disgraceful episode, Ruggini's former friend Julius Evola publicly denounced him for Masonic affiliation. Curiously, Evola had just published the Imperialismo Pagano, a set of articles borrowing considerably from Ruggini's essay with the same title and calling on the fascists to avoid political and ideological compromise with Catholicism. Decades later, Evola would acknowledge that he owed his awareness of genuine initiation to Ruggini and Guenon. At this stage, Ruggini, Guenon, and Evola went on separate paths. In 1930, Guenon, who continued to be ambivalent about Masonry as a true source of initiation, left Europe to devote himself completely to Islamic studies in Cairo. Evola would soon drop his intransient pagan imperialism and condemn Freemasonry on the grounds that it could not provide any genuine spiritual initiation. He would go on to cultivate a view diametrically opposed to that of Ruggini's, seeing the Catholic Church as the successor to the Roman Empire, as well as developing his own peculiar brand of racism that was to influence the fascist regime. In the 1930s, Ruggini devoted himself to teaching and to the study of the Pythagorean interpretation of numbers, proportion, and harmony, seen not simply as an intellectual game but as a key to life. His approach somewhat resembles that of the 19th century English Neoplatonist Thomas Taylor, whose work he quotes in correlating spiritual and material reality with numbers and proportions. Regini's book on the reconstruction of the Pythagorean geometry, containing notions, quote, on which Freemasons would do well to meditate, end quote, was published in 1935, was praised for its scientific value by the Accademia d'Italia, Italy's equivalent to the Royal Society. As World War II came to an end, Regini intensified his work on the Pythagorean numbers, perhaps sensing that his time was short, he left detailed instructions concerning his manuscripts. At 5 o'clock, on the hot afternoon of July 1st, 1946, in a country villa near Boulogne, he died standing in his study, facing the western sun. In one of his later works on the relationship between mathematics and the spiritual quest, Regini stressed that true philosophy involved the direct experience of the seeker. He wrote, "Modern Western science is objective experimental science, achieved externally by instruments by which aid the senses. Its purpose is to observe, understand, taking into account the inevitable alteration, the Heisenberg principle, made on the observed conditions by the observer. In Masonry, Hermeticism, Pythagoreanism, and esoteric science of all times, the observer is also the object of the experience considered internally and directly without limiting the field to any imaginary columns of Heracles, not so much a matter of theorizing as of feeling and living. And what indeed is the purpose of philosophy, the love of wisdom, if not, as the Neoplatonist Porphyry said, to free our mind from the limitations and chains." That is the end of the paper. I will say that California-born Dana Lloyd Thomas now lives in Rome. He's written articles on Pythagoreanism, alchemy, and Oriental medicine, and is writing a book on Arturo Regini and esoteric traditions in Italy. The full paper will be available in the app, complete with all of his notes and references, so you can look up all his cited materials. It's really good. I hope you enjoyed. I was going to split this up, but I thought it was so interesting to kind of take us through and really dig in. There were a couple quotes in this article that I just found fascinating, particularly his comment that he said that Continental and Anglo-American Masonry were more obsessed with high-sounding titles than with the spiritual perfection of the initiate. This was the best quote in the article for me, because this is what we do. We don't allow Masonry to be spiritual with us, and I think we really should. It's kind of what it's all about, really.
There is a common scenario that in one form or another seems to crop up in almost every initiation. At the end of the degree, the master gives the attendees a chance to introduce themselves and speak if they wish. Congratulations abound, and at some point, one of the brothers will tell the new initiate, "You will get out of Freemasonry what you put into it." Another day, another cliche. Then there's that other scenario. You meet an old acquaintance whom you know to be a member, and he tells you he dropped out, saying, "All they wanted was my money." Did you ever stop to think those two overworked remarks are related? Take, for example, our two esteemed brothers, John Doe and Joe Dokes. John and Joe are the same age, and like all of us, have family responsibilities and demanding jobs. Raised the same evening, their Masonic journeys take two distinct paths. John dives right in, starts helping out around the lodge, participates in the social functions, and eventually fills in for officers in their absence. He participates in degree work, becomes interested in the ritual, and begins reading articles about its meaning. The incoming master asks him to step into the officer's line, and his progression through the chairs begins. He eventually becomes master, serves on Grand Lodge committees, joins appendant bodies, his lodge of research, and maybe writes a couple of articles himself. Joe, on the other hand, attends a few meetings after his raising, but loses interest. Every once in a while, he comes to a meeting, but doesn't have much to say. He's not involved in any of the lodge's projects, and most of the planning just bores him. He stops going to meetings altogether and loses touch with his brothers. They, in turn, don't bother to stay in touch with him since he's drifted away. Joe's proud to be a member, thinks Freemasonry does good things, but something seems to be missing. Each year, John and Joe receive a couple of pieces of mail from their lodge and maybe a couple more from the Grand Lodge. Face it, most of those letters contain an appeal for funds. Then, one day, years after becoming members, John and Joe receive their annual dues notices. John pays and doesn't think much about it, except maybe that it's a small price to pay for the value he gets from the fraternity. Joe, however, looks at the statement and thinks back to his only contact with the fraternity this year, those appeals for funds. And now, it's not an appeal. It's mandatory. He decides it's not worth it and tosses the dues notice in the trash. All they ever want is my money. It is true that we as members have an obligation to stay in touch with brothers who are no longer active and to encourage them to become involved. However, another cliche comes to mind. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. The ultimate responsibility for making this fraternity, or pretty much any other life experience, rewarding, lies with each of us individually. When things get boring, do something about it. Dare I mention, when the going gets tough, the tough get going? In the end, both Joe and John are right. Joe was right when he said he only heard from the members if they wanted money. He was also right that something was missing. Unfortunately, what was missing was Joe himself. John, on the other hand, indeed got out of Freemasonry what he put into it. Most cliches become cliches because they are tried and true. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, another fantastic segment by illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison. If you like that kind of content, you have to subscribe to our YouTube channel and check out his videos. Follow him on Google+, because he's releasing those videos there as well, and it's fantastic. He's got some great books out there. Go ahead and go to wcypodcast.com and click on the bookstore, which will take you to just a website. We've compiled links to all of the books from brothers of the show, and you can buy those books via Amazon. And there's no kickbacks to our show or anything. It's just hot links to those books. But boy, they are fantastic, especially this kind of content is wonderful, and you'll find that all over the place in Tales from the Craft. However, my personal favorite is, of course, Freemasonry and Oak Island. I'm a sucker for conspiracy stuff. And now, I think in the program, every once in a while, I will make mention of some sort of interesting thing that has happened in the world of the sciences. You know, we are charged to pay attention to those liberal arts and sciences. And we took a poll a long time ago that said, would you guys be cool if we talked about some up-and-coming scientific discoveries or whatever? And overwhelmingly, people said, yeah, like, you should totally put that stuff in. And I was actually kind of sidetracked here looking at some articles about memory. So much of what we do, if you're an active Mason, your memory is a big, huge part of being able to perform ritual and cite dialogue. And one of the things I got sidetracked doing was researching based on this idea that I came across an article that said old age protein, that's in quotes, may cause memory loss. And it got me thinking, is this like an issue? I don't see that with our older members in Masonry. They're largely very active and they remember stuff. So then I thought, well, how do you prevent this quote unquote old age protein? It's actually a protein that impairs the formation of new brain cells, and that contributes to age-related memory loss. So if you could stop that protein from building up, then presumably you could stop memory loss. And that got me thinking, like, well, how do we, what do we eat, or what's the vitamin that stops that protein from happening? And really, it looks like the one article I got kind of sidetracked reading about was younger blood introduced into older people tends to stop that protein from developing. So that was just kind of tangential to what I was actually trying to read about, which was, as it relates to the 24-inch gauge, we're supposed to get 8 hours of sleep or refreshment. And I found this quick piece on some new insights into why sleep is good for our memory. So by actually following the 24-inch gauge's recommendation for sleep and refreshment, it helps us to be more active in the memory dynamic of what we do. It says, sleep, they show, helps us to use our memory in the most flexible and adaptable manner possible by strengthening new and old versions of the same memory to similar extents. The researchers also demonstrate that when a memory is retrieved, when we remember something, it is updated with new information present at the time of remembering. The brain appears not to quote-unquote overwrite the old version of the memory, but instead generates and stores multiple new and old versions of the same experience. Now this is kind of interesting, right? Because we have computers that do this all the time. When we're using cloud drives or whatever, it's always asking, hey, what version of this do you want us to keep? Or do you want to keep both? And our brains are like, keep both! The results of the research carried out at York's Sleep, Language, and Memory Laboratory, or SLAM, are presented in the journal Cortex today. The lead researcher, Dr. Scott Kearney of York Department of Psychology, said, quote, previous studies have shown sleep's importance for memory. Our research takes this step further by demonstrating that sleep strengthens both old and new versions of an experience, helping us to use our memories adaptively. In this way, sleep is allowing us to use memory in the most efficient way possible, enabling us to update our knowledge and of the world and to adapt our memories for future experiences. End quote. In the study, two groups of subjects learned the location of words on a computer screen. In a test phase, participants were presented with each of the words in the center of the screen and had to indicate where they thought they belonged. One group then slept for 90 minutes, while a second group remained awake before each group repeated the test. In both groups, the location recalled at the second test was closer to that recalled at the first test than to the originally learned location, indicating that memory updating had taken place and new memory tracers had been formed. However, when comparing the sleep and wake groups directly, the locations recalled by the sleep group were closer in distance to both the updated location and the original location, suggesting that sleep had strengthened both the new and old versions of the memory. Corresponding author Professor Gareth Gaskell of York's Department of Psychology said, quote, our study reveals that sleep has a protective effect on memory and facilitates the adaptive updating of memories. For the sleep group, we found that sleep strengthened both their memory of the original location as well as the new location. In this way, we were able to demonstrate that sleep benefits all the multiple representations of the same experience in our brain. The researchers point out that although this process helps us by allowing our memories to adapt to changes in the world around us, it can also hinder us by incorporating incorrect information into our memory stores. Over time, our memory will draw on both accurate and inaccurate versions of the same experience, causing distortions in how we remember previous events. The study builds on research model created by Ken Paller, professor of psychology at Northwestern University in the United States, who is an eminent researcher in the field of memory and a co-author on the study. The research was funded by the Economical and Social Research Council, the ESRC. Materials provided in this article were from the University of York. And that article is on sciencedaily.com. What I find interesting is, you know, how many times are we in ritual and we deliver it perfectly, but then somebody corrects us? And so then moving forward, maybe when we're doing the ritual, we're not quite sure. We can't really remember, were we right the first time or were we corrected and that was right? And maybe that builds. And then finally, over a period of years, maybe we've been corrected enough times for that the correct memory of the correct words to be said just based on what feels stronger to us in our memory. It's just interesting. I thought you guys might find that somewhat edifying. And that's really it for this week. So if you like Masonic Podcasts, please keep coming back for this program. Please go over to our website, wcypodcast.com, hover over support the show, and support the show by either making a direct donation one time, whether it's 50 cents or $5 or whatever it is, that really helps out. But what helps out even more is a monthly contribution, and we've got that set up also. We have three tiers to be able to do that, so you can contribute $2 a month, $5 a month, or $10 a month, and you can stop it whenever you want. But it's a really really awesome way to continue helping this program bring you the best content possible and to continue bringing you additional Masonic education in the various forms we have, like our new YouTube channel, Masonic Curators. There are some other ways you can do some shopping listed under there as well, so just make sure you're clicking through our links and using those promo codes that we offer you. That way the sellers know where you're coming from and know who to throw a few dollars back to help keep our lights on. Please don't forget about the Masonic Roundtable going live every Tuesday at 10/9 Central, and the Midnight Freemasons publishing new articles every Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And right now we've got a pretty cool series happening every Friday. The first two pieces have been released, The Matrix, its symbology within the Matrix, and kind of how it relates to Freemasonry. Two articles again have been posted. We've got two more coming out this upcoming Friday and the following Friday, which is a really good wrap-up. So please check that out. That's it. So continuing on our positive message going into the Yule season, I hope you guys are happy and you pay it forward. And it's not about giving dollars. It's about giving yourself, giving your time, giving your abilities, and going without a little bit. Maybe instead of sitting on the couch, catching up on your shows or your Netflix, binge watching some stuff, get out there and go help somebody. Go do something. And if you don't know who needs help, try to find somebody who needs help. You know, we owe it to ourselves to get out there and really be charitable in the sense of action. It should be actionable. It's not a dollar thing. It's an action thing. So with that, I hope you all have the best week ever, and I'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.